back, everyone, to a special bonus episode of Cinema d'Amore. I am one of your hosts, James Reinhardt. I'm here with my usual co-host,
Justin Morgan.
And we have two guests. They've been on before, and I feel like, you know, this is an appropriate episode to have them back. So please welcome back, guys. Introduce yourselves.
I'm Alex Casson with Indie Ground Films.
And I'm Alex Chaloner.
And yeah, I'm glad to have welcome back. You guys were on our Hereditary episode last year, which is still one of our most popular episodes. And you also schooled us all on Folkhor a few years ago on our old podcast, so I felt it was appropriate to have you guys on.
It's a theme.
Which we would have re-released that episode the day before this one came out, so you can go back and listen to it.
Oh, good. All right. Add a few more listens.
But yeah, that was the math. It was Ari Aster's second film plus folk horror equals
Alex and
the
Alex.
Alexes. Yeah, I call you the Lexi. I don't know if that's rude or not.
It's Alex Pod. It's Greek. So
I call you the Alexes.
That works.
Yeah.
I call you Lady Alex or Hun. All right, cool. Anyway, thanks for having us back on. We'll be fun.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to have you guys on and the chat about horror movies and folklore and all that stuff. And well, I feel like Hereditary had folklore elements. This is definitely full on.
Yeah, which was part of the issue with it. But, I'll come back to that, loop around later. But yeah, this was, I guess, his attempt to just do something full on folk horror. And it definitely was the end.
Yeah.
It's a short episode.
Yeah. I don't know. My thoughts on this movie are long and complicated. And I feel like ultimately it's a very well-made movie and a very effective movie. I was definitely very shaken when I left this movie. I feel like my comparison is spoilers, but I keep saying that if you've seen The Wicker Man, then you've seen this movie. Like it.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think that's ultimately my big issue with it is it felt too familiar.
And just to
familiar.
Clarify, we're not talking Nicolas Cage, Wicker Man. we're talking the,
73.
No clarification on that. It could possibly be the Nicolas Cage.
Well, I thought, with the bear suit. I'm like, like the Nicolas Cage Wicker Man. But yeah, like I think that was ultimately my issue with it is this film felt too familiar once I realized what was going on. I was like, oh, okay, I know where this is going.
Yeah, there just weren't really any surprises, and I was hoping there would still be something at the end to kind of keep us interested, but yeah, I think maybe about two-thirds of the way through, I just knew exactly how it was going to pan out, and I was quite disappointed by the end.
Yeah, I think when we saw the original trailer, I was very excited for it, but in the back of my mind, and I've said it verbally quite a bit, is that I hope that there's something more to the movie than what the trailer presents. So, and it was pretty much exactly what you would expect.
Yeah, because I remember when you and I were talking about this, and we were talking about doing a podcast, and you were saying, like, you said that to me. You go, like, yeah, I feel like the trailer, I hope that there's more than what we're seeing, you know. And I agreed. And
spoilers, it's not. Yeah. I mean, it's all exactly what it is on the surface. So. But I enjoyed the movie for the first kind of half. There's one moment where it goes off the rails and it doesn't really recover for me, but I guess we can build up to that. But in terms of style, I think he went lean in on the folklore elements. He did a ton of research. It seems like, along with Hereditary, he really likes to dig in on, I guess, folk stories and you know, build up out of that. And I think that the layers of the actual like village and the time period it was put in or the time of year it was put in, the visuals was all really well done. So I commend him for that.
Yeah, I loved the visuals. I felt like he's really good at composition. Like a lot of his shots look like paintings. Mm. And also lots of really good visual foreshadowing, which he did a lot in Hereditary as well.
Yeah.
So I really loved a lot of that stuff. This weird, like, it's almost like a Wes Anderson type style, but for a horror film.
You know, I thought Wes Anderson when I was watching this 100%, like where they had the camera like panning and it would just like be one character doing something for a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's like, but if he wasn't funny,
trying to be funny. Like if Wes Anderson really wanted to make you uncomfortable,
Yeah. Well, like the reveal of the bear is a good example of the framing. You're following along, you're kind of tracking backwards, listening to a bunch of people talk and just natural conversation. And then somebody's like, are we not going to bring up the bear? And the camera pans to reveal. And it was a really well done moment. And I was saying this after the movie yesterday, is I think the best choices the director made were the way he foreshadows, which is like a random cutaway shot of something that at the moment isn't relevant. It just gets us from one quick scene to another quick scene, but then we loop back around. So it's adding a little bit of dread on like, oh shit, what is that going to be about? So there's a shot of somebody sitting in a room, and before the end of the scene, you just cut into an image on a wall of a bear on fire that somebody drew. Or the shot of the Oracle kid when he's first introduced, it doesn't make sense within that scene why we cut away to the Oracle kid, but now all of a sudden we have this like terrifying image that we come back to sort of later on in the movie. So the foreshadowing, I think he did really well. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the kind of two things I really enjoyed about the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to compare to Hereditary that much. Like, I feel like I keep doing it, but I don't.
There's a lot of comparisons, though. It feels like he wrote the scripts back to back. He got the money for Hereditary. It was a big hit, and they immediately jumped in before even Hereditary was released. They knew it was going to be a really good movie, so they gave him funding to go do the follow-up without actually, like, sitting there and doing another rewrite, which he probably needed. But, like, the ending of both movies was identical. The kind of trajectories of the characters were pretty similar.
Yeah, because I was thinking about that, where this film is, both films are kind of about characters being reborn in a way, and being reborn into something worse, but also I had a line of reasoning I was going down, but I've now completely, these characters who, they have some sort of personal crisis going on, and there's external forces that are manipulating them without their knowing, using these crises against them. It's kind of like the whole point of both these movies is kind of like the world doesn't really give a shit about what you're going through and will, in fact, use that to, and people will use that for their own agenda without a second thought towards your feelings. But you come out feeling like you've won, but you haven't.
Yeah. They do feel very similar in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think the thing that like draws me into this movie the most is how real the characters feel. I know you're talking about, like, you didn't like how familiar it was, and you don't like how long. And I felt it felt long, too. I read an interview with him, and I don't have the whole thing. I'm just kind of paraphrasing it a little bit. But he was talking about one of the problems that he thought when he was going through with it was that everyone's going to know how this goes. They're going to know the trajectory of this film as they're going into it. But he also saw it as, and I don't know if you've seen it the same way. I can see it. His personal, he's like, for most of the characters, it's folk horror, but for the main character, it is a fairy tale. Her story ends up being kind of like a morbid, but works out kind of well for her, or oddly, in an obscure world.
Yeah.
And he also has it, like, he in his mind as a breakup film.
Oh, it's totally a breakup film. Yeah, there's that. Is kind of clear. So the idea of the movie is that she's trying to get over this grief of losing her family by finding a new community to be a part of. And if that's all the movie was about, that would be fine. That's totally okay. The characters felt realistic. The guy from Bandersnatch was funny and seemed like a good brosy character.
Mm-hmm.
There was Josh, he was, I can't remember what his actual studying was,
anthropology, I think.
Yeah, so his investment in the adventure that they're on was fantastic. I liked Christian only at the point that I liked him at the beginning, that's her boyfriend. When you realize he's only staying with her because he feels too guilty to dump her because of what happened to her family. And then from that point on, he's not really an interesting character until he decides to write his thesis on pageantry as well as Josh was doing. So now there's a conflict between those guys. So there were moments that were really good, but the moment that went off the rail, like the movie never recovered to me after Josh died. So he basically, getting into the plot a little bit, he is a college student. He's friends with all these guys. They go up to this little remote village in Sweden to watch this pageant that takes place over 9 days, and he's basically going to write a thesis on it. At one point, he gets up in the middle of the night to go take some photos of this book that they kind of use as their Bible, and he gets killed at that point. We never really see anything with him again until the very end. And from that point on, the movie, to me, should have started culminating, coming to an end. But then there's an hour of like singing and dancing and nothing terrible happening, and it's just all really, really long and like masturbatory filmmaking. And then like the end wraps up really quickly. So there's like an hour of absolutely nothing happens after this character that you actually like dies.
Yeah, and I like character I'm a big fan of the show The Good Place, and he's on the show The Good Place, essentially playing the same character, but also that's the point where I went from disliking the character of Christian to really disliking the character of Christian, because he's like, hey, I'm going to be doing the exact same thing you're doing. And I think we've all met that person, like Christian, who kind of has no personality of their own, but just like leeches off of the people around them.
But liked about that, whether you like him or not, like, that's conflict.
And yeah,
There's no conflict in the movie for the main character. Like, her family dies, she's dealing with grief, and at the end she decides to burn her boyfriend alive. And like, okay, that's something. Yeah. all the other characters have, like the couple from London, they want to leave, but the locals won't let them. That's conflict. That's interesting. Character, or Christian, decides to write a thesis, the same thing that Josh is there for, and Josh is dedicated, whereas Christian's kind of like a tourist in the subject. That's conflict, and that's interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
But then once Josh dies, like, that's it. Like, the London tour or London characters are dead, and Josh is dead, therefore all the conflict in the entire movie is gone now. And now it's just watching people spin around in circles.
Yeah, I do agree, because I disliked him, but I liked that conflict between those two characters. But yeah, that at that point, like, I'm like, he's a shitty boyfriend, and he's just like a shitty guy all around. Like, I
do feel like he was trying really, really, really hard not to bang that girl, though.
Yeah,
so at least give him some credit.
He was trying. Ultimately, he gave in. But
I love the waiting room that seemed to go into another waiting room too. It's just where you know that he's going to discuss that, where you find out he's discussing the possibility of sleeping with that.
When he sits with the elder lady.
Yeah, he's sitting in a waiting room, and then they go into like another fucking room where he sits and waits. Well, I guess that's a store, like where. I guess that's the main office, but it looks
Swedish
to me. I like, the architecture's funny because it looks exactly like the same room. Like, they couldn't do it in that room. They had to bring him back one more room to do that.
Roomception. Keeps
going. So when I saw this, I saw it the night Spider-Man opened. And I was hoping that I'd have the theater to myself because everyone was seeing Spider-Man. But then a few people stepped into theater for me. And even though there was plenty of open seats, like I was sitting in the middle of my aisle, and an older couple sat in the same aisle with me. And they had thoughts on this film. And they were not going to hold their thoughts until after the movie ended. Nor were they going to speak their thoughts in a hushed tone. They're just going to say it out loud while the movie happened. And this movie was 10 times better with like a live baby boomer commentary, like right next to me.
You should have busted out.
Do you have any classic hits, like greatest hits?
Just like, is he on drugs? I think he's doing this because of the drugs. Oh, that's because of the drugs. or the scene where he eats a pube. They're like, oh, that's that girl's pube. Just thoughts like that. And I'm
because
like,
of the drugs.
I was like, I want every horror movie now to have a live baby boomer commentary. But then when the film ended, like as soon as the credits came up, like the woman, she stood up and loudly goes, well, that was the stupidest movie I've ever seen. And stormed out.
That's almost like every movie I see, that person exists where they have to announce how much they hated the movie and they leave.
Yeah. And I'm like, I take it the movie probably didn't make you feel good, because I don't feel good right now, but there are worse movies out there.
Oh, sure. It was a beautiful movie and it was well made. So one of the other things I enjoyed about the movie had nothing to do with the movie itself, but if this is some people's introduction into folk horror or kind of art house horror, I can see how they would really appreciate it, or they would take something away from it. But like seasoned vets like us, like, just go watch Wicker Man.
Yeah.
Just go watch Wicker Man.
Yeah, so, the when I was thinking about it when I left, I was like, yeah, Texas Chainsaw Massacre too, because the scene where Josh is killed really reminded me of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And even that was a point where, like you, where I thought shit was gonna ramp up, because like he gets brained, a dude, someone from the group is wearing his friend's skin.
Yeah, that was great.
And I was like, oh fuck, like shit's about to get weird. And then it didn't, but
well, it did like an hour later.
Yeah, like an hour later. Yeah.
Well, then like the orator person that whoever was writing the book,
the Oracle.
Kid, Ruben, I think his name was.
They made him out to be like super creepy, and maybe he's wearing that kid's face. I don't know.
No, it wasn't him.
He doesn't seem...
IMDb credits. There was somebody else credited as...
Wasn't it the guy that was pissed off that Bandersnatch pissed on the tree? Oh, that was him. I think it was that guy that then skinned his face off and wore it.
They make the person of incest to be like a monster, but they never really do anything that makes them like... They're probably the best character, like the nicest person in that village.
I thought that character was going to have much more of a role to play. I feel it was a shame that it didn't really have a point to the story. I felt that you could have taken that out completely and it wouldn't have changed anything.
I feel
it could have been a really interesting.
Yeah, I think that's could have been something that set it apart from something like Wicker Man or other films where you kind of know what the overall plot of the story is and done something a bit different. So...
Although saying that, I just recently read Harvest Home by Thomas Tryon, which was released in 73, same year as The Wicker Man. And that there's definitely some similarities there as well. And that novel, there's a girl in the village called Missy who the villagers believe to have some kind of powers of premonition. And so she's used in their various rituals and festivals and stuff to kind of pick certain people for things that happen. So I thought the Oracle in Midsummer was maybe going to have a bit more of a role like that to play. So I don't know whether Ari Aster read Harvest Home and thought, yeah, that's interesting, I'll add that in too, but won't actually develop it into anything.
Yeah, yeah, because I kept waiting for that to be more... That to somehow pay off that he was like an Oracle type character.
The only thing that I can kind of piece together is... So in the movie, they've got... they talk about the Dark One as this like devil creature or Lucifer type person who did some bad things to the village thousands of years ago or whatever the actual like story was. I think it was zoned out at that point. When we're introduced to the Oracle, he's kind of scribbling on a piece of paper and he's creating what looks to be a figure with, I would guess, like dark skin. It was like dark brown. And then later on, it's the one black character in the story is the guy that goes in to take the photos of the Bible, which he's been told he can't do. He's trying to like bring information from the village to the outside world, and that's when they club him and kill him. So I didn't know if maybe the Oracle was predicting that we need to keep an eye on this guy because he's going to do something that we don't want him to do. But they never did, they never leaned into anything. Like that was the only thing I can come up with the entire purpose of having that Oracle, other than having a creepy looking kid.
Yeah.
So it's a disappointing part of the movie because it plays a bunch in the trailer and he's in the trailer just about as much runtime as he is in the actual movie.
Well, that's probably true. I don't think I even saw the trailer, but he was in the trailer. That is probably all of his.
Yeah.
He's only in there for like a shot, I thought.
He's in the movie like three times. There's that all three times for like maybe a total of a minute.
There's also that one shot too, I think. Is he in there during the like the sex scene thing? Is that when they show him where he's like laying on the cot oddly?
Yeah, I think
like
they do, yeah.
For no reason, they cut to him and he's just chilling. And then
I think
I don't remember where that happens in the movie.
I thought that was when Josh got brained. He was in the room in the background.
I don't know.
Yeah.
There's a shot where he's just laying in a cot, and I thought it was like a really odd timing because he doesn't do anything. He's just like,
yeah. I knew this was going to happen. It would make sense, I guess, if it was when Josh got brained. If he's predicting.
Yeah, because he was kind of...
if my theory is right.
Yeah, like, I guess, caretaker of the book or whatever.
Yeah.
So maybe he slept in the same room as it. I'm not quite sure. It wasn't very well explained.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, yep. And then, the whole ending. So the ending of The Wicker Man, spoiler here, is that the main character gets kind of dragged into, like, 50-foot-tall Wicker Man and lit on fire. And the ending of this is the main character's boyfriend gets stuffed into a bear suit and then put into a building that gets lit on fire. So very similar kind of endings, although they played, I guess, different purposes.
Yeah.
The girl becomes kind of like Beyonce, though, right? She's Queen Bee by the end.
Yeah, she's she's their May Queen.
Yeah.
And he's burned. He they need 9 sacrifices.
God, that whole exposition of the whole 9 was terrible.
Yeah, and he's burned with the other 9. I mean, the kill, like, it's one thing how this movie did well, and I think it's why it got into my head so much, is you don't really see a lot of the violence. You see the aftermath of it, which allows you to fill in with your imagination what, like, their friend was, you know, their friend Will Poulter from Black Mirror. He's presumably, you know, a girl leads him off, he thinks, to have sex, and you don't see what happens to him until after, later, when one of the people's wearing his skin. So he's skinned and then, like, stuffed with straw and given a jester hat. And then the other bodies are, like, deformed in some way. Like, that one dude's, like, strung up in a chicken coop with his, like, his lungs ripped out. Like, to me, like, the fact that these are so grotesque bodies and they're arranged, like, artfully, that kind of disturbed me. And the fact that at the end it's treated so happy, like, it's treated as a very positive thing, which I think worked, was why the Wicker Man, the end of the Wicker Man works so well, is they're all celebrating the death of this man, this horrible death, but the film doesn't treat it as dark. It treat it positively.
Well, I feel like the difference between the two is in Wicker Man, you know, there's some, you have an ominous feeling throughout the movie. There's a sense of dread that things aren't right here, but he's completely unaware of like the level of shit that's about to happen. And us as the audience, we're completely unaware of like the, of what's about to happen. So it takes you by surprise, but it makes complete sense in retrospect. Whereas this, you're like, we know halfway through the movie that people are dying. It's only a matter of waiting another hour and a half until the main character figures it out.
Yeah.
And like that is where I disconnect. I'm like, well, if we're not watching through her eyes or there's not an immediate sense of dread, anything around her actual character. So I don't know. I was just completely zoned out at it. I didn't want it to turn into kind of a schlocky horror action thing, but I feel like that would actually been a much better movie is if they shuffled all the deaths closer to the end and they just cut out a lot of, like, they lean full bore into the pageantry aspects of it, and they spent so much time just singing and dancing without moving the plot along. Like, everything that we need to know about the villagers being, like, crazy, odd folks out in the countryside, like, we understand that in a half hour. We don't need 2 hours of it, and that's what they gave us, was 2 hours of it. So if they had condensed the moment from, like, once the bodies started disappearing and we don't get to see what's happening to it, to the moment that we reveal that they're all in danger and, you know, her boyfriend's going to die and she's going to be transformed. If all that was shortened down to a 15-minute time period instead of an hour and 10 minutes or whatever it was, I think it would have just ran a lot smoother. It would have made us, like, think that she's in danger or care a bit more about what's happening. But the fact that we just had to sit for that hour with nothing happening just pissed me off so much.
To me, because they plant the May Queen thing really early.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, she could be, do they sacrifice the May Queen? Like, is that the whole thing? Is, like, he's manipulating her to become the May Queen so that they can do some sort of sacrifice? But then at the end, you find out it's not really. No, she wins. She gets to choose the final sacrifice that she chose her boyfriend, who she just saw, you know, fucking another woman.
Yeah.
At the end, it's, you know, she was never in danger. She was always in, you know, she was always being built up to become this, you know.
Maybe not as exciting, but it feels kind of twisty to me because I expected her to die.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think becoming the queen was going to be a good thing, and it did. I agree with the runtime. I definitely feel that it should have been slimmed down even 20 minutes or so just to make it a little bit tighter. And I would say its greatest sin is probably, like, okay, you're familiar with folk horror, so you see where it's going. But I feel like people that are even slightly familiar with just horror in general, there's too much shit going on for these people not to be questioning what's going on around them.
Lack of conflict.
Yeah, they like the show, like, I mean, the foreground, like, there's things constantly happening in the background that just seem off-putting.
Mm-hmm.
And none of these people question it. And maybe it's the drugs. I don't know.
Maybe it's the drugs, yeah. So one of the things I liked about Christian's character that we touched on a little bit earlier is the fact that the writer, well, director did a good job of setting up why he wouldn't want to leave. And the reason he didn't want to leave was because he decided he was going to write his thesis on it. But the payoff to that is that she needs to want to leave. And he says, no, I'm going to stay and do my thesis on it. But we don't have that moment of conflict between them. We just have, he has conflict with somebody else who dies. And then it kind of goes up in smoke. And we never have her wanting to get out of there. We never, he sets it up on like why certain people would want to stay or ignore all the shit that's happening.
What does she come up? She comes up to him at one point in the movie when he's talking, he's finally getting to interview somebody about his thesis, and she like wants him then. Like I don't remember if they wanted to go then, but they were kind of set him up to be like
she goes up to him because the British couple, like the dude disappears, and the cult people say like, oh, he took the truck into town. He's gonna send the truck back. And his girlfriend, of course, doesn't believe him. And the main character, she goes to Christian, and she's trying to, she's concerned, so she's voicing her concerns to Christian, and he is just uninterested. He is just doesn't give a shit because he's too wrapped up in his thesis. That's like really the only conflict we get with, because I was expecting like a full on relationship blow up between the two of these.
And then we have another hour of singing and dancing.
Yeah, because the whole, this is a
relationship. Some people like singing and dancing.
Yeah. It's a, well, again, like going back to Wicker Man, like Wicker Man was a musical. Like it's nonstop singing and dancing through the whole thing. And I think that was another thing he's trying to completely nick here. But it's a big difference when it's 90 minutes versus 2.5 hours. And sorry, just to wrap up a point from earlier. So I think one of the flaws pacing-wise could have been fixed if they had moved the best scene of the movie, which was, in my mind, like when the old people committed suicide, like that was the best scene of the movie. If that was the very beginning of the final day, now we don't have to worry about the characters going like, spending 4 days going, oh shit, we need to get out of here, or not saying we need to get out of here, like, old people committed suicide, some people disappeared mysteriously, and we're still there for a few more days. Like, I don't buy that time frame at all. But if they just condensed the ceremony to a couple days versus 9 days, I think it really kind of eliminates a lot of my problem with it.
Yeah, because the old people committing suicide, you know, they explain it that, like, that's the end of their life cycle and their culture. But, you know, but yeah, if I was in that position, like, I would be like, oh, well, we're going now. Like, I just watched these people jump off a cliff. And even Josh didn't seem put off by it because he seemed to know what that was. But yeah, like after that, a lot of the characters seem to have taken that too well.
I do like Christian defending it, though. He's like, it's part of their culture, babe. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. See, but yeah, so if they had said, look, this is only going to be one more night. Like, it doesn't matter if we leave tonight or tomorrow. Like, this was the penultimate evening. Let's just wait for this to get over and go. But it wasn't. It was like a week.
And yeah, I didn't find it believable that no one physically tried to leave that area. I know the couple from London did at some point, and obviously didn't, but they didn't physically try and walk away, even though it was really remote. If you were really put in that position, I think someone would try and just try and make a run for it and they figure it out.
Yeah.
And no one even tried that.
Or like go up to other people and be like, well, I'm leaving right now. And are you coming or not? Like there should have been a moment where the London girl was saying that to the main lady. But yeah, I mean, I would.
Because, you know, the people would have still tracked them down in the forest and brought them back and killed them, but we didn't have that. We would have
got that scene.
Yeah, because I thought that was coming too, where at some point they're just going to try and run. Because, yeah, I do think maybe the problem is, like, lack of stakes. Because, and, like, I do agree with you that I think the old people killing each other should have been pushed back, because that really escalates the stakes really fast. But, yeah, I feel like, especially in movies like these about ultimately the big faceless cult is more powerful than you, and then nothing you do, it's always about the characters being helpless but not knowing it. And I feel like a scene of them all trying to escape and being caught and brought back would have really emphasized that these characters are ultimately helpless in the face of this big faceless commune
or maybe they try, it doesn't even have to be the community itself, but the landscape, like you try to run away and all of a sudden like, I didn't realize there was this fucking quarry. There's all these beautiful mountains and trees and everything else around. And then all of a sudden, we're in this, like, I don't know where that mountain came from with the suicide rock on it. But if they tried to leave and all of a sudden they're at the edge of a cliff and they turn around, there's a village there and they have to go through the village to get home. Well, shit, we'll just stay another night there.
Or, like, a more modern village, but they were, like, in on it kind of thing.
Or they just couldn't get to it. I mean, I don't want to, like, tell them how to rewrite it and get back to it and remake the movie. But it just feels like, yeah, no, the heightened moment of the movie was these old people killing themselves. And then the next big moment was coming to an end, you know, all of it kind of coming together an hour later. And there was literally nothing in the movie in the set. Like, it was interesting seeing the boyfriend get this love potion given to him, and the details. We were talking about this, like, the director's really good at kind of planting some details. There was obviously the pube thing that showed up in, was it a mural earlier?
Oh, yeah, the panels earlier of the love spell, which got many a gasp from the cinema crowd.
The crowd in my theater.
Both of them.
We had a lot of awkward laughter. Things that were not, like, when they showed the people, like, burnt up, you know, when they pushed them onto the fire before they were, like, cremating them or whatever they were doing. Yeah. People were laughing, and I'm like, I get that that's, like, a trigger that people have for awkwardness, but...
It was, like, the old people, then, like, a couple younger, a lot of younger people in my... I feel like they couldn't get in to see Spider-Man, so they're like, we'll go see this movie.
Well, I thought that... So there's a row of, like, four women in front of us, and I think we came in after them, but I just assumed they were kind of, like, mid-20s. They'd probably been to a few horror films before. And their reaction was very kind of naive and youthful throughout the whole film. I'm like, it just doesn't seem like, have you never been to an R-rated movie before? It was just really weird. And they're gasping at, like, the...
Maybe they thought it was that nice dance movie. You
maybe,
know?
Yeah. You should go see Climax. But then as we were leaving the theater, we walked past them, and they all look like they're maybe, like, 18, and this was their first foray. And it's either going to ruin R-rated horror movies for them, or it's going to, like, get them really interested in it. And that's what I think is good about the movie, is if you're new to the genre, or you're new to kind of art house or kind of highbrow horror films, if this is your first foray, then it's probably really interesting and could open up your mind a little bit, and you can go and explore, and there's a million things out there that we could recommend you go see. But if you've seen this before, then I found just incredibly boring.
Yeah,
I think to go back to something Justin said earlier about an interview with the director and saying, you know, he was making a folk horror film and he basically just wanted to follow the formula of that. Once I read that online after we'd seen the film, I realized, well, that makes sense. I guess you accomplished what you set out to do. I just don't really understand why that would be your aim. Like, why not try and do something else with that subgenre and keep it surprising and interesting?
Because
it's quite disappointing.
I've always wanted to write one, and I've been working on one on and off the past couple of years. And, like, I want to, you know, make it folk horror, but I also want to make it different. And, like, this one scene, the scene in this one, they're all tripping. Like, in a lot of drafts of mine, there's, like, a scene where they're using drugs. And I was like, oh, man, now we have to rethink that because, like, I feel like now it's been done, you know? And,
oh, I mean, like, Field in England is a great movie about, like, four people tripping on mushrooms in the field. And, like, so there's a lot you can do within the genre, even if you're kind of treading over ground. Like, you know, witches used potions and shit like that. And there's hallucinogenic drugs used in all sorts of different cultures. So there's tons of ways of using the same tropes over and over again. Mm-hmm. But that's different from, like, remaking a classic in a new kind of setting. And I think that's basically what he did here.
Yeah, and I guess you brought up, like, if this opens doors for people to do more of these movies, and good on this, because I think, for me, it was probably what we discussed in our folk horror episode, The Kill List. That was, like, my first exposure to folk horror, but also kind of art house horror, I guess. Mm-hmm. And, like, it got into my head, and I was like, I think I really like that movie, but it was weird as shit. And that,
are we talking, sorry, Kill List? Kill List is fantastic.
Yeah, it's great. I love it. But that made me want to keep watching movies like this. So maybe, you know, this film might be someone, like you said, someone's gateway drug into more folk horror movies.
Yeah. Well, I look back at, like, one of the gateway drugs, or gateway films for me was Bullworth back in the 90s. And it was just open up the door to kind of weird art house film. And I'd be scared to watch it now, wondering if it's, like, actually really terrible, but it just happened to hit me at the right time. Or, like, American Beauty was another one that I really liked when it came out, but if I watch it now, it's probably not nearly as interesting.
I think that's most of America, American Beauty. Yeah. Most people that watch it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering if it'll be like this for certain people, is that this could be a gateway movie into something interesting, and then when they come back and revisit it in 20 years, like, oh yeah, it's not actually that great.
Yeah.
But what if in 20 years you love it?
I will be surprised.
I would question a lot of things at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, like you say, I think there's things I really, really appreciated about it. And I did love, like, the foreshadowing elements that the director did, and I liked the brutality of the violent scenes. That was all done incredibly well.
I thought it started off really strong.
Yeah.
The beginning was so dark and disturbing and had some really haunting imagery. I could really feel for the character of Danny. I thought the actress was great. And getting to know all the other characters was really interesting. So all the setup was really good. But I think, then it became predictable. And the end, compared to how disturbing it started off, was just really unsatisfying.
Yeah.
It didn't compare to how it started off. I think unsatisfying is
the word I would tag with this movie for sure.
But I'd say the best part of the movie probably was that opening scene too, because his... not just unsettling, like, in your gut, you don't know her sister, but you're just there like, no, this doesn't feel right, nothing, and it feels real, because it feels like it could be anybody that you know. You could easily put yourself in her shoes there, and, it's not so much, like, when she gets the news and you know it happened, I think that's so much worse than even when you see how it happened, what went down. For, I don't know, maybe I'm a sociopath, no. And it wasn't that... It didn't bother me as much. It was worse just hearing her reaction over the phone.
Yeah, that he cuts away. Yeah, exactly. You hear her screaming over the phone, so you know it's terrible news. And then he later reveals what actually happened. But then there's theories that it was all set up by Pele?
I think it's Pele.
Pele. Where he chose her thinking that he wants to bring her back to become the May Queen. He sets it up by killing her sister and her family to kind of set all this shit in motion. And I don't buy that as a theory.
I think that's like the art house horror for you. It's like, we didn't explain, so
yeah.
Go to town with your imagination.
Exactly, yeah. But, well, I mean, like, the explanation is sister has mental issues and she went over the edge and she killed the family. And then that caused lead actress a lot of grief. And, like, that on the surface, I could totally buy. But I've read, or multiple people have suggested that it was all a plan from the cult from the get-go, which I just don't feel.
Yeah, I was wondering from the beginning, I'm like, is this being set up? Was this set in motion by them somehow? And I thought the film would explain that, and it didn't. But I feel like with him, it seemed like his main objective was to get his friends to the village as sacrifices. And then when she came along, like it seemed like the implication is that he was just always into her. And when she came along, that was like an added bonus for him.
That's how I read it. Also, we never have a satisfactory ending with his character. Like, he just kind of is wearing this crown and is thanked for his efforts for bringing the sacrifices. And that's kind of it. Whereas, like, I feel like they should have had a moment. He did run up and kiss her at some point during, right after the May.
Well, they're all, like, marching along.
Yeah. But that didn't feel like the ending of things. There still should have been some resolution with his character.
Yeah, I agree, because, the whole film is very unsettled by the fact that he's into her.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I thought. I'm like, so this could be the whole thing. They're going to end up together.
There should have been something.
Yeah, that was just it.
I don't care what it was. It just needed a resolution.
Midsummer 2, the day after.
Yeah. There's some confusing bits in the film as well that I don't know where the confusion comes from. But so it opens with a mural of some sort with like the four different seasons and some kind of foreshadowing what's happening. And that kind of opens like a curtain. So it immediately we're kind of feeling a similar vibe to Hereditary, which the whole story, it kind of relies on these like miniatures and whatnot. So it gives you a weird perspective on what we're watching. But it opens up on, like, the forest in Sweden in wintertime, or we assume it's Sweden at that point. And then she calls her family back home, and it's still nighttime, so it must be the same time zone as her family, but we're, or at least me, I don't know if anybody else had this issue, thought we were in Sweden. So her family's in America. She's in Sweden. So is she an exchange student? And then she's talking, one of the first people she talks to is her boyfriend, but then the first non-boyfriend person that we meet is the Swedish guy. So I'm like, is he in America or are we in Sweden? So I was immediately lost in the geography of the whole thing, which really put me off. I forgot what other point I was going to bring up. But oh, so the 90-year festival, do they, all the villagers, so basically this festival takes place every 90 years. People have to be sacrificed for, you know, growth of crops or whatever the hell the fuck it was. But the... all the villagers seem very, very confident in their dance moves and the pageantry and what they wear and how all the events unfold. When do people stand up and follow other people's toasts and drinks and where, you know, like all of it was very well choreographed from the villagers' perspective. But if they only do this every 90 years, none of them were alive the last time this happened. So how often do they do festivals? How often are the festivals? So like, I didn't understand any of the actual like background of the festivals.
So. Yeah, that didn't make any sense.
Yeah. If you kill your elders when they're 72 years old, that means there's like an 18-year gap where nobody is alive. Like, if it's every 90 years, but everybody only lives 72 years.
Yeah, there's no one to tell the story.
Yeah, how is this information passed along? Like, do they still do a festival every year, but it just, they don't do the full-on ritual? So they've got all the other stuff down, but they don't actually kill anyone?
Yeah.
It just wasn't very clear. It should have been expanded upon, I think.
Yeah. With and the whole like reveal of we kill 9 people, 4 from outside, 4 of our own, and hey, one's a toss up. Like that entire scene was just so.
And then awful. Bingo! Yeah. Like what?
Yeah.
I agree with you there. The 9 just seemed like they didn't have enough time to explain, and it just was like, it's 9 because it is. For the festival thing that you were talking about, I just kind of felt like they did something every year, but they didn't do the May Queen thing, I don't know. Because I felt like they had to be killing off the 72-year-olds every year. I don't know if... I mean, yeah, there's definitely questions. They're not a part of the sacrifice, apparently. Or maybe they have to be killed off when they turn 72. And if they're not doing the festival, then it's not... it doesn't count as the 9 or something.
Yeah.
Your opening shot like that you were talking about... I thought it did go to, like, California or something. Like, it looked like Los Angeles or something to me. It didn't feel like Sweden.
Yeah. The trees there. Yeah, the trees were definitely not
California. Yeah, I thought the landscape at the right at the beginning with the music, like, there's, the, like, a female singer, I think it was. Mm. Yeah, I thought, oh, this is probably Sweden in the winter. But then I can't remember exactly what the visual was, but there was at some point I thought, this is not Sweden. We're now in the US, and we're focusing in on someone's house.
Here. I mean, when the phone phone rang and the trees went away, I thought that was a cut to.
To her parent. Well, that's where the confusion was. So the first shot is trees in wintertime that looked very much like Swedish landscape.
Yeah,
and then the phone starts ringing, and we're zeroing in on a suburban American house. So to me, that's saying one person's in Sweden on one end of the phone, one person is in America on the other end of the phone, and we're getting them together for this moment. But it didn't make sense because one was dark. Oh, well, I guess it's wintertime in Sweden. It's dark all the time, so that could have been justified. But, like, not knowing whether she was in Sweden and they were in America, and that's where they had to call. And she's like, hey, sorry for calling so late. Like, hey, maybe I don't know my time zones. It's an 11-hour difference or whatever. Like, I don't know. There was right off the bat.
Once you start bringing time zones into
was muddled right off the bat for me.
I understand your confusion. I think this is how I took it. Like that forest is Sweden in winter, but her and her parents are in America. But I guess they must not be in close proximity to each other that she couldn't just drive to check.
It's really easy to put a little title card that says Los Angeles.
But
get rid of
Nart, not an art house cinema.
I took it that they were all in the city together for school. Sicario did it. Her and these people. Because I think of Pele, they mentioned that they send people in a cult out on a pilgrimage.
Sure, but he didn't. He said that like an hour into the
movie. And so this was his pilgrimage. He had gone out and gotten to college somehow.
I buy foreign exchange students, but I didn't know if these were Americans at a Swedish university or if he was a Swede in an American university. That wasn't clear right away. It took a little bit.
Yeah.
So, and then there's a lot of like camera movement, very deliberate camera movement that was interesting, and it was made to make you feel, I guess, a bit discombobulated or a bit kind of out of it. But once you get to that point, just like move on. And that's where I
It got very repetitive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, like very masturbatory feel to it.
Yeah. It was, you know, it's fine to begin with, but it got old pretty quick.
There's that one shot early on where she's talking to Christian and she's like in the doorway and he's reflected in a mirror in the other side of the frame. It's
some great framing.
It's some great framing, but also artsy directors love that mirror shot. Mm. And I'm just like, oh, I see what this is now. And you're like, this is one of those movies.
James will never do mirror shot.
Cross that one off. But there's like great framing in terms of like how there's sometimes where she's in a separate location on the frame from the group, and sometimes Christian's separated from the group. And so the way he picked his framing and did his blocking with his actors, I thought was really great. And, you know, like you mentioned earlier, one of you guys mentioned earlier, how it looked like a painting a lot of times. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, it looked beautiful and it was well put together, but it just went off the rails. So.
Yeah, and I feel like I've been very critical of the film and very bashing it.
Good.
Which, you know, no film is perfect. I think overall I did like this film. Like I said, it was effective. Like from what your interview you read of him sounds like he accomplished what he set out to do. And like I said, I was kind of disturbed when I left the film because even though Christian's a shitty character, we still watched him get burned alive, which is a terrible way to go.
But he was drugged up. He probably wasn't even feeling it. Probably didn't even know it.
Everyone was feeling it.
Yeah, everyone was.
I like those guys that were like just that moment of pain where that just felt like maybe they were second guessing themselves.
Yeah, because they're given that drug and it's like, yeah, you'll feel no pain, and then they start screaming. It's like, no, they're still gonna feel pain. But like it was an effective movie, and I think overall I enjoyed it. But this was definitely, I think, a sophomore slump for him after Hereditary, which felt so fresh. It felt so new. And the whole movie, you're like, is this a possession movie? Is this a haunted house movie? Is this a satanic cult movie? And then it's kind of all three in a blender. And that's why I think it works so well. But it's also a very character-driven horror film, which is rare and kind of hard to pull off. And I thought it did it well.
Well, I was wondering if he is rushing out something else now. They rushed to get this out, and are they doing something? But on IMDb, he's got nothing.
It doesn't feel super rushed me, but you know what I was thinking in this movie?
Well, production-wise, it felt like they took enough time and did it, but I feel like the script just absolutely needed another pass.
I was kind of feeling, they said it had nothing to do with Hereditary, but for a moment I was feeling like we were going to get to another demon. Remember how there were like eight demons or something?
The first time I saw like a runestone in this, I was like, oh, maybe it's tied into eight.
That's what I thought.
I was thinking this is just another one of the other demons, and it's going to...
That would have been
this is his shared universe.
And then at some point I thought, like, when they mentioned Dark One, I thought, oh, so is there going to be something supernatural at the end of this? Like, because the whole movie, you're assuming it's not, it's just a cult. But then I started thinking, like, oh, is there going to be a supernatural twist at the end? And there wasn't.
Well, I was wondering if the Dark One was written in reference to, like, the bear, like this giant bear. And that's one of the reasons they, like...
They burn it.
They burn it.
I mean, I thought they were going to feed her to a bear or something for a moment.
Yeah.
Like, when she was up on that thing that they were carrying her, they're going to throw her in something with, like, a less subdued bear.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you knew the bear was coming to play somehow. You don't put a bear in a film and then pay it off. You know, it's like...
Well, you also don't put a mutilated oracle.
Like, it's the old, if you introduce an act in act one, if you introduce a gun in act one, it has to go off in act two. It's like, if you introduce a bear in act one, then obviously a man has to be sewn up inside his skin. And
I think some misdirection's okay. It would just be bad if, like, nothing at all, like, that bear never came into play.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have mind that, actually. I think just like we don't have to see every moment of the pageant. So like setting up that there's weird things that are happening that we're unaware of, I wouldn't have mind that.
For me, like the bear suit thing, it really reminded me of the Nick Cage Wicker Man. So I thought, like, did he watch that and think this would be so much better if he was in the bear suit when he got burned alive? And that's like how he wrote this movie, is just that one thought.
I think he tried to do, from his interview, I don't remember everything he was saying, but he was trying to get like, obviously, it's made up, but he's trying to make it as historical to, like, some Swedish things that he could find. So, like, he did find, I guess, the sacrifice for the old people, like, jumping is something that is, like, historic that's happened.
Yeah.
And then he said with, like, the hammer, you know, how they had to go finish off that guy that didn't die. He was just in a Swedish museum, and he's, like, saw, like, that exact type of hammer and was like, yeah, that's what we need to finish them off, like... No history there.
Yeah, like say, I like the deep dive into like weird folk traditions. I think that was great, but I think that he abandoned making a good movie in exchange for having some really cool historical shit.
I would have been out of there the minute they were all happy. I drive up with my friends. everyone's off being hippies.
I'm not a big fan of sunshine, so I would have walked away. Yeah. We're going on vacation up in Scotland in a few weeks in the middle of summertime. So we're going to, if it's not very similar when we get up there, it's in the middle of nowhere, an island with very little amount of people. So if it's not like people singing and dancing and sacrificing animals, I'm going to be very disappointed.
So, well, thank you for being on our last podcast. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. If you guys go missing, I'll send help.
It'll be very expensive to get there. It's very tough. It's a remote island.
You're definitely dying. Oh, God, you guys. Exactly. You're definitely gone.
Yeah. I will. If I come back, I'll come back with a script, I promise.
So this is kind of tangentially related. Like I said, some of this reminded me of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I was having a conversation with someone on Twitter where they're saying that they think Texas Chainsaw Massacre is folklore. And I was just thinking before I even saw that person started talking to them is – I was thinking about the subgenre of like redneck horror.
I call it like Americana, like folk.
I was like the redneck folk horror.
Deliverance is another good example.
Yeah. I was like that's like the American folk horror, the rednecks. I was just wondering what you guys' take was on that.
Yeah. Well, I think, and I haven't brushed up on this, so this is going by my terrible memory, but I think folk horror specifically, it isn't necessarily folklore, but there's just something about folk horror that has to be like tied to the earth. Mm. So I think some people expand folk horror to include anything that's folklore related, which obviously opens it up quite widely. But then I think there's a purist folk horror, which means it has to be related to the earth. So it couldn't necessarily just be occult related or satanic rituals or whatever. It has to be more like pagan and old gods and earth related.
Yeah, so there's some purists who are like, there's only three folk horror movies ever made. There's Wicker Man, Blood on Satan's Claw, and
Witchfinder General. I'm a big proponent for Blood on Satan's Claw. That made a big impression of me on me at a very young age.
I thought that about you when I saw
I saw that in college. I started rewatching
it. It's worth a visit.
A few months ago, I never finished it, but I loved Witchfinder General. I love Wicker Man. But yeah, I saw Witchfinder General and Blood Sings a Claw in college, and they really like had a big impression on me. But yeah, I was thinking about that because I was thinking, you know, the redneck Americana folklore, which I like that term, where it's like, yeah, that's kind of like our American version of it, whereas this is more of the British folklore.
Yeah, I feel like something like The Witch can be, I mean, it's more occult horror, but it can be called folklore if you go with a very kind of broad brush on it, which would be different than kind of Americana horror. But like, I think, yeah, Deliverance, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, things like that definitely fall under that umbrella.
We just did film noir, and the folklore reminds me a lot of, like, it's this genre that is not defined that well, where, like, somebody, you called yourself a purist, it's like, no, it has to have this, this, and this all checked off. And somebody else is just like, well, you know, it had enough elements that I would consider it the same.
It is, but it's a, until I talked to you guys about it, it was a subgenre that didn't have a name, and I feel like a lot of people still don't have that name, because as Jordan Peele was singing Midsummer's praises, and he called it pagan horror. But that, to me, falls under the folk horror umbrella, and I've seen other people call it that, or call it like cult horror.
It's cult to me, but I mean, there's a lot of, like, I don't know, bleed over into one and the other.
I was just gonna go off on a slight tangent, because there was what I think some would classify as folk horror. There was a film we saw recently that I just wanted to give a bit of a shout out. It was called Without Name. It's an Irish film from a few years ago, and it was basically about a man and a forest. And it was
a lot of drugs.
It's kind of a low budget thing, so some of the storytelling and some of the acting wasn't perfect, but there was a lot I liked about it, and I would definitely recommend it for anyone who's looking to expand on Midsommar, because that also had some drug-related hallucinatory visuals. There were some really beautiful visuals, and the music that went along with it I thought was really well paired. It was a slow burn of a film, but a really interesting one.
Much more interesting, I think, than Midsommar. But, yeah.
Because it did its own thing. It was surprising.
Yeah.
So that kept it interesting.
It also, there's another subgenre we'll throw at you that we can go into another day called speculative fiction or speculative horror. And that's something like Alien would be a good example of it, where it's sci-fi, but it's grounded in things that could actually happen. And I feel like Without Name was a really interesting film because it was both folk horror and speculative horror at the same time. So anyway, if you liked Midsummer, congratulations. But if you want to keep looking for other things, I would definitely check that out.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot we're rehashing what we said in the folk horror episode, but that's fine. You know, this is like a part two to that. But yeah. But yeah, I feel like if you did like Midsummer, check out Wicker Man. Even if you want to see the Nick Cage one, it's worth a laugh.
Actually, there's like a six-minute video for the Wicker Man, the Nick Cage one. That six-minute video on YouTube is way worth watching, not the movie.
Just Google six-minute Wicker Man?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I can find it. It's hilarious. It's just all the best. It's like the greatest moments of Wicker Man. And if you saw it, you would think it was the funniest fucking movie of all time. And you would go watch that movie and then be disappointed.
Yeah, I watched it because of that six-minute clip. And it's... It's god awful, but those scenes out of context are hilarious.
It's like Nick Cage like staring some woman down and then like punching her in the face and then running away. And then he's in a bear suit and you're like, what the fuck is happening?
Yeah. And he's in a bear suit and he's punching women in a bear suit. Like I said, I feel like Ari Aster watched that and he's like,
it sounds like a Will Ferrell film.
It almost is. Like it's really tonally confused the entire movie. But the ending's still the same. And there's bees too. There's like a thing.
Oh, yeah. Not the bees. Yeah.
Not the bees.
Yeah. but yeah, kill
that way he's in a bear suit.
I mean, that's acting. Yeah.
I remember like I was making fun of it to Steve. And Steve's like, okay, if you're Nicolas Cage and you have to, the script says, oh no, not the bees. Oh God, the bees are in my eyes. He's like, how else would you act that scene?
Yeah.
Like, what else?
There's
like,
only one reason you can cast Nicolas Cage, and that's for that line. Right there.
That was like the beginning of the end for him in a way, like because he was kind of like on top, and then the Wicker Man came out and
burned him alive.
Yeah, and you know now he's kind of in the middle of a comeback, I think. But
yeah,
you know. But
really quickly, other Swedish films was Insomnia, the original.
I've never seen the original Insomnia.
Yeah, with what's his face from Chernobyl.
Skarsgård.
It's him.
Is it him? I don't
know.
I'm not sure.
But Nolan did a remake of it that was pretty good. But the original, it's another movie that takes place in like all daylight, 24 hours a day. And then shout out to some of my favorite like Scandinavian dramas. Like if you like Swedish TV, there's Killing, The Bridge. What else is there?
There's some dark Scandinavian.
Yeah, it's just really good like noir. It's, Scandinavian noir TV shows out there that I definitely recommend checking out.
I think I'm blanking on Swedish films other than Let the Right One In, which is amazing.
Ingmar Bergman.
Yeah.
There's some art house films for you guys.
Yeah, there you go. Cool. Well, thank you guys very much.
Yeah. I guess before we wrap up here, final thoughts on
Sorry, I'm jumping
again. Yeah, you're ready to get out of here, yeah.
It's okay. I enjoyed the movie. Maybe I'm naive, maybe I'm new. Maybe I was just tricked because I feel like a lot of the shots and stuff are set up in very interesting ways that pull me in. I do think that the movie drags a little bit too long with no payoff. I agree with you guys there. And thanks for being on. I like your suggestions because there's going to be somebody that watched that movie and they're going to be like, I love that movie. And then they're going to listen to Alex and be like, you guys need better opinions or you need to see some other things.
I don't mean to come across as a snob, but like, yeah, I mean, I think that there's, if it's a genre that interests you, there's a lot of stuff out there that is worth exploring. Obviously, we've discussed it to death, but like, it's a very nebulous term. If you go onto Wikipedia and just put in like folk horror, there's some really weird things that people associate with folk horror. But, you know, explore. Is good stuff.
I did say one more dumb thing, and this has nothing to do with this conversation whatsoever.
That's really dumb.
And we release our Inglourious Basterds episode, and Mike Myers got brought up because he's in Inglourious Basterds. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, he kind of gets a name drop in Midsummer.
Oh, the Austin Powers reference. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, they come in and like, do you guys want to watch Austin Powers or not? And it just like left, like of all movies, why Austin Powers? But anyways, that I owed it to people that listened to Inglourious Basterds first and then wanted to listen to this because I didn't want to ruin any of Midsommar for Jim, who's on that episode, who was just left, just saw you guys as he left. I was so excited to see that movie.
Yeah. That's a good one. That's the last
Tarantino. I'm really glad I saw it. It did fall short of my expectations, but I'm glad that people are enjoying it. I'd still be interested to see what Ari Aster does next because I really, really enjoyed Hereditary. So I think Midsommar had some interesting stuff going on, really strong acting, and it looked beautiful. So definitely had some plus points, but it just got a bit drawn out and predictable for me, unfortunately. But I'm glad people are enjoying it.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to sound like I've just been kind of shitting all over it for an hour and a half, because I'm glad we went to see it. I'm glad we saw it in theaters. It was a fun experience watching other people enjoy it, even if I couldn't enjoy it myself. I think he's a really talented director. I think his movies look phenomenal. And it'll be interesting to see what he does next. I feel like I said earlier, I think he wrote these two scripts side by side, and then we'll see what he does next.
Like I said, I've come off very critical of the film, and I don't want it to, people to think I didn't like it, because like I said, it did its job, and it did its job well, and ultimately I think it's a very well-made horror film, and most of the horror community I've noticed online seems to be very receptive towards it. So good to have fans, but yeah, I think this is what kept me from really, really enjoying it, is that it just felt very familiar to me, and I felt like I'd seen this film several times already before.
I mean, you don't have to like or love it, or you feel what you feel, right?
Yeah.
You feel what you feel.
And I felt nothing.
Well, thank you for being on. We're Cinema D'Amore. We're at Cinema D'Amore, Facebook, Twitter. That's where you follow us to tell you what's going on. And you guys, your indie ground films.
Yeah, indie ground films. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Movies coming out soon. We'll go there and we'll tell you all about them.
And I go under the name Hey Little Thrifter online, where I have an Instagram account and a YouTube channel where I mostly talk about horror books.
Nice.
Despite the thrifty name.
And you guys can find me at James Reinhardt on Twitter.
I'm at JJ Morgan 19. And Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, that's where you find us. Please subscribe, rate, and review us, and thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you.